There's so many interesting things in the Colbran Bible. I don't know where to begin, but I'll give you this from chapter 3 of the Book of Creation in the Colbran Bible. It is known, and the story comes down from ancient times, that there was not one creation, but two, a creation and a recreation. It is a fact known to the wise that the earth was utterly destroyed once, then reborn on a second wheel of creation. At the time of the great destruction of earth, God caused a dragon from out of heaven to come and encompass her about. The dragon was frightful to behold. It lashed its tail, it breathed out fire and hot coals, and a great catastrophe was inflicted upon mankind. The body of the dragon was wreathed in a cold, bright light, and beneath, on the belly, was a ruddy-hued glow, while behind it trailed a flowing tail of smoke. It goes on to talk about the destruction of the earth. It is just part of a very fascinating book, which some people claim is as old as the Bible itself, the traditional mainstream Holy Bible. The Colbran. It's a new special edition out from Glenn Kimball. We'll talk about what's in the Colbran Bible and what isn't in there, and what does it mean for us today? What can we learn from this most ancient of books? And more importantly, what does it tell us that we would never have guessed about our origins on this earth and the galaxy? And we'll do it next with Glenn Kimball on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett. Glenn Kimball, it is always a pleasure to talk with you.
It's always been fun for me too, Ian. We've been old friends.
So, no big surprise, though, that somehow with Glenn always comes a big backstory. And I love this about you, that you are always going into areas and doing things, and you've always got something going on. But you got to have to help me right away before we even get into the story of the Colbran Bible on why I'm getting emails that says you've bootlegged the Colbran Bible and that that this is an unauthorized Colbran Bible or something. What's that about?
The Knights, the Fraternal Order of the Knights Templar that preserved the Colbran Bible from the 1184 AD, the surviving entity that was dismantled in 1995, dissolved because there wasn't anybody willing to take on the chivalrous code of the Knights Templar.
Yes, sir.
These people in 1992 sent out versions of the Colbran in all four directions in the world in order to make sure that this book was preserved and maintained. There are people who would like to suggest that there are groups of people who own this particular edition or own the Colbran outright. That's not true. It's just simply a fallacy. There are copies of, or there are versions of the Colbran in Lebanon, there are versions in the Vatican, there's still some in England. There are versions of the Colbran. Our particular version came to us as it was sent to a historian in India. And certainly this was not a pirated edition. What they're referring to basically is the fact that there was another version published just shortly ago, prior to our publication, comes out of New Zealand, out of the good people in New Zealand. But it's been expensive, extremely expensive to purchase here.
Okay.
And so we have attempted to search the world to find another source for the original text, which we were absolutely amazed that we found a copy of it and granted to us, and we have published it here in America in order to fulfill the intent of this surviving Knights Templar fraternity, and that was to preserve the text for the entire world. We tend to have people who hold up the Holy Bible and say, we own it, or they hold up the Nag Hammadi text and say, we are the only ones who can speak about it, or the Dead Sea Scrolls, or the Kibra Nagast, or the Bee Bible, or any number of different ancient texts, when in reality these things cannot be owned by individuals or groups. They were intended for the entire world.
Well, I've totally dug reading it. I've been reading it now since you sent it to me like over a month ago, and I'm fascinated by it. I just had to say that here in the last second, I just started getting these emails about that, and I love the fact in a way that there's, you know, intrigue about the idea of you getting this book out. But this is a book that people can purchase. You can find more at ancientmanuscripts.com. This is the Glenn Kimball special edition of the Colburn Bible. Let's talk about the history of it. Let's lay it out for people that didn't read about it in the After Dark newsletter, which is always available if people want to grab that at 888-727-5505. So let's start from the very beginning, because you believe that at least the earliest parts of this are written in what biblical scholars would call the intertestamental period.
Yes, the earliest part. The Colburn Bible is different in the sense that it reads like a textbook. And it was a collection of the ancient teachings of tribal people of Great Britain. And it comes from many different sources. It comes from the era of Scota. It comes from the era of Jeremiah. It comes from the era of Joseph of Arimathea. It most certainly comes from the traditions of the lost 10 tribes of Israel. You know, the Saxons are called the sons of Jacob in their most westward migrations. And so this text comes to us like an instruction manual. And maybe I can help you a little bit to understand it by saying that when I was young, I read a book called The Drama of the Lost Disciples, not commonly available in America. It is available in tandem with the Colburn at the website, ancientmanuscripts.com. But in that book, Joeth, the great British historian, suggested at the time of Jesus that the great Druids, who were called Magi by the Romans in Latin, the Latin version of the Druid in their period of time was called Magi, the same fraternal order that visited the birth of Christ. These Magi wise men were teaching courses of study, and Joeth says there were as many as 60,000 students in these great schools. And I, you know, being kind of an investigative journalist, someone who does a profiling, looking for manuscripts, you do a profile saying, here's where a manuscript should be. Let's go look for it. I look for the text that was used in these great schools. It couldn't have all have been just verbal. It had to have been written down somewhere. And guess what? It was written down, and it was hidden away at the time of Edward I or Longshanks from Braveheart fame. Remember
sure.
The movie?
Yeah, that would be the Patrick McGoohan character.
Yes, exactly.
Right.
And you know, Longshanks did a very strange thing. He invaded Wales and burnt the Glastonbury Abbey to the ground. This is historical. This is not a guess. He burnt one of the most sacred sites of Christendom in all existence. This is the place where Joseph of Arimathea was, where Jesus was rumored to have visited himself personally, where the Virgin Mary had been, where the grandmother of Jesus had visited, where Mary Magdalene and a potpourri of biblical characters beyond imagination, including many of the apostles themselves, had been. Longshanks did not go and burn this sacred ground, which had been operating as like a sovereign nation for 1,000 years. He didn't burn this to the ground just to be mean. He went there to burn this to the ground looking for evidence against the Templars. The evidence contained within a document. That document was the Colburn.
All right. So help me with the narrative. So the Colburn is written in, you know, this period right around 0 BC, you know, give or take time on either end. It is collected in its final form by what year, do you think?
I think that the final form of the collection of this Old Testament version was intact by the time just after Joseph of Arimathea in the second century.
So just at the beginning then of the second century, maybe even late first century,
you think
the Colburn would be already established. Then what happens to what? How did the Knights Templar get involved? That's hundreds of years before the Knights Templar.
That's correct. It was hundreds of years before the Knights Templar. But these schools existed for a long period of time. Out of the schools came very famous characters like Lucius Sejanus, the son of Claudius Caesar Britannicus, and, of course, Constantine, who was born, raised, and educated in Great Britain and knew the material that was in the Colburn Bible. These documents survived as a curriculum, as a course of study, and these were being taught all the way up until the time of the Crusades in Great Britain. The Knights Templar took possession of these things for a very specific reason. First of all, they were the protectors of the Vatican, and they considered themselves the protectors of these manuscripts as well. And they colored the documents with their own culture and traditions.
So they redacted or they edited parts of this, or they added parts of it that reflected the Knights Templar point of view.
They certainly did, which does not diminish this firsthand journalistic account of historical events, the story of the exodus from Egypt that comes from Skota, who was the daughter of Ramses II or his descendant, was a story of Moses. She was the caretaker of Moses. She took care of the baby Moses. She married a Hebrew. Her husband had trained his own people to be mercenaries, which helped him preserve his political entity. You could not occupy ground without being invaded in those years by one country or another. So he trained his people to be mercenaries and work for the Egyptian people as the defense against the Ethiopians to the south. But they eventually went to Great Britain. And we get the country, Scotland, named after Skota. Arthur C. Clarke writes about that in his research.
Really?
That's exactly right.
Okay, so Scotland comes from the name of the caretaker for Moses, the caregiver of Moses.
And her story appears where? In the Colburn. It is the most magnificent independent tale of the Exodus and the time of Moses in existence in our day. What a precious beyond gold.
Well, there's some very interesting stories that also parallel other things, other stories which even, you know, non-religious people would have heard growing up, stories of creation and stories that are ones which we might consider to be apocryphal stories or stories from which we're supposed to learn, you know, these sort of morality tales that are in the regular Bible. But this Bible itself, could we look at it, the Colburn, as was it considered a rival Bible? I mean, was it considered an alternative Bible or a complementary collection of works at the time?
It certainly was never intended to be a rival. It was intended to be a curriculum course of study for the great schools, the learning schools of the common people, and the religious or the mystical people in Great Britain. It was like a textbook, teaching them about the creation of the world.
Then why suppress it? Why was it ever suppressed?
It was suppressed because Longshanks found a portion in the narrative of the Colburn Bible which reflected the Templar opinion. Now, remember who the Templars were. The Templars, the first nine Templars, were all, without exception, members of the Fraternal Order of John, or John the Baptist. John the Baptist, when he grew up, he stayed his entire lifetime in Palestine. He never left. Unlike Jesus, who went after the death of his father, Joseph the Carpenter, had the advantage of having his great-uncle, Joseph of Arimathea, take him on merchant vessels and visited many places during his life, along the Silk Trade routes and back to the homeland of his grandmother in Great Britain, and was not located. The missing years of Jesus are missing because he wasn't there. But these were cousins. These were families. John the Baptist was the eldest, even though it was only by a short period of time. But after the death of Christ, in the Exodus of the Faithful, Joseph of Arimathea took the bones of John the Baptist back to be buried in the homeland of his mother, Elizabeth, which was Great Britain. And if you look at the histories that have been propagated on the television and in history books, they'll tell you that the Knights Templar were worshippers of the Beheaded One. They even worshipped the head. In fact, beneath the big pillar at the Roslyn Cathedral is supposedly buried this head. Or who's this head? The head is John the Baptist. It was the head. It was the reason for the instigation of the use of the Jolly Roger flag or the Beheaded One. And so the Knights Templar.
Get out! Is that true? That the reason why we have the Jolly Roger?
That's correct. They all the Templar merchant vessels flew the flag of the Jolly Roger in honor of their patron, who was John the Baptist. Now, so what we have here is we have, from a perspective of the Templars, they reverenced Jesus as being a holy man, but they thought that their illustrious birthright ancestor, John the Baptist, was really the antecedent for the coming of the Messiah. That's why Longshanks went to find this particular book in the Glastonbury Abbey and to destroy it, because remember the reason why the monarchs of Europe, the Philip the Fair and the Pope Clement V, which lived with Philip the Fair, they went in to destroy the Knights Templar. Remember the two reasons they used to exterminate the Templars? It was because they spit on the cross of Christ and because they had deviant sexual practices. They didn't have deviant sexual practices. These were men whose chivalrous nature often did not allow them to marry, and so they were suspect off the bat. But the first one, when they said they spit on the cross of Christ, was because they reverenced John the Baptist as a senior member of this movement over that of Christ, though they reverenced Jesus too. And so what Longshanks was trying to do was he was trying to find evidence to pick a fight between the Vatican and the Templars in order to do what? In order to exterminate the bank. The Templars were the first bank in existence in the world.
Well, the first international bank where you could, you know, you could invest your money on one end of the road in the Crusades and you could take your money out on the other end.
And Longshanks and the kings of France and Spain, etc., were all heavily in debt to the Templars. And by exterminating the bank, they figured they could exterminate the debt.
All right, so the Templars hold the Colbrin. Does that mean then that the Colbrin was continued down in the tradition of the Templars and passed to the Masons?
Exactly.
Okay, so anybody who was, a 33-degree Mason, they would have already have known about the Colbrin.
Or a degree higher than that, yes.
What do you mean?
Well, I'm not of the Masonic Order, but there are members who have of the Scottish Rites, which once again is Templar, which is also John the Baptist territory. There are there's more people in the hierarchy than just 33-degree Masons.
Okay. So at some point, they might have already been told about the Colbrin. So it might still continue on through Masonic literature, secret Masonic literature.
Exactly. And it's been kept secret and away from the monarchs of Western Europe for 830 years.
Well, the reason why I ask is I was curious whether then there was any proof that, say, Thomas Jefferson or George Washington or anybody else would have been exposed to the Colbrin Bible.
Well, let me give you a hint. We found, I don't know if you remember the book Holy Kingdom that we discussed years ago. I think I sent you a copy. I'm not sure if I did or not. But remember Adrian Gilbert, one of your very good guests,
sure,
that's been on the air.
Like him a lot.
He wrote the book Holy Kingdom with the research of the very brilliant Alan Wilson, Mr. Bram.
Mm-hmm.
They had on the cover of their book a sword, if you remember right. That sword was from the Arthurian epic of time, from the 6th century A.D. It was found where? It was found on the East Coast. And I didn't know this until just a couple of weeks ago when we were looking at the sword very closely. On the blade of that sword, written in the ancient Negev, which was the original text, the language of the Colbrin.
Glenn, you got to hang on to that thought, because I come back and I want to ask you about that and how this ancient book, the Colbrin, warns us of a space threat. Coming up on Coast to Coast AM. This Colburn Bible thing's pretty darn interesting. You can find out more at ancientmanuscripts.com or just link up to Glenn Kimball at coasttocoastam.com, where you'll see several other very interesting stories there on the front page. And remember, too, you know, this is what the After Dark newsletter does so well. 1-888-727-5505. Always looking ahead and pulling out some pretty interesting things that haven't popped up in the mainstream media yet. And I don't know whether this book will get the kind of traction it deserves, but it sure is an entertaining read and informative too. Because this very ancient book, how ancient, we don't quite know, but it too has a couple of different stories of creation. And it also, unlike perhaps the mainstream Bible, speaks to something which is a controversy to this day. And the idea of humans coming from apes, very much in the news, right? Intelligent design versus evolution. And I read you a part of the Colburn Bible, at least, you know, 1,000, 1,500 pages, sorry, years old, if not more. When heaven man was reborn of the she-ape in the cavern of woe, could he taste the fruits of the earth and drink of her waters, and feel the coolness of her winds? Did he not find life good? It is not a tale of the courtyard. I think there's a very interesting thing here about the creation story in the Colburn Bible. Behold, the great day came when the spirit, which is God, was joined with the beast, which is earth. Then God, sorry, I'm going to put on my glasses. When earth writhed in the labor of travail, her mountains rocked back and forth, and her seas heaved up and down. Earth groaned in her lands and shrieked in her winds. She cried in the rivers and wept in her storms. So man was born, born of upheaval. So man came forth, man, the child of calamity. Man, the inheritor of a creative struggle. Man, the battleground of extremes. That's just way cool. The Colburn Bible. We'll get back to this. Did our founding fathers have exposure to this? And what of this ancient threat as these voices warn us of a possible unpleasant intergalactic conflict? Coming up from the Colburn Bible, next with Glenn Kimball on Coast to Coast AM. I've really enjoyed reading from this, the Colburn Bible. Glenn Kimball is here, and he's got the latest on this, too. So we're just talking about how, and I'm sorry, we're getting to the very bottom of the hour, but that you believe that our founding father, somebody like George Washington, somebody who's a Mason, could have been exposed to this, even though really, I mean, very few people on the planet knew it existed then or know that it exists now.
Yeah, we have two doors open, but let me make a comment about the last passage you read. Just a very short comment. The Colburn also talks about, after that period of time, the coming of Adam and Eve. And that story is so beautiful and poetic. It's probably the most brilliantly written story of Adam and Eve ever written. But it is the reason why this is the only religious text or historical text that forces science and creationism to sit back down at the same table and look at each other in the eyes, because this is 850 years old, and it was predates Darwin. If Darwin would have known about this, he would have felt a lot better about his divinical training.
Well, I mean, but here, I mean, that whole thing about the she-ape, I mean, that how did that pop up? It almost makes me feel like somebody wrote that now, because it reflects a sort of this modern debate.
Wouldn't it be wonderful if we could approve? Wouldn't it be wonderful if in fact, I'm telling you, it's true that this comes from an ancient source long before Darwin?
What's the oldest living copy we have? Oh, living copy. What's the oldest extant copy of a Colburn Bible? I mean, where we can verify, you know, this not a copy of a copy of a copy, but I mean the oldest original text we can find.
Well, we're talking about being able to find evidence of it from the time of Edward I in 1184 A.D.
Okay,
and so it's at least that old. That predates Darwin. But then we open the door too about the founding fathers. We talk about this sword that Adrian Gilbert had wrote about and had on the cover of his Holy Kingdom. It shocked the devil out of me a couple of weeks ago when I realized, written in this ancient Negev language, which is called Old Hebrew by many linguists, really is an Old Hebrew. It predates Eber, who was the father of Peleg and Joktan, Peleg being the patriarch of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and Joktan being the patriarch of a civilization that went and merged with it in the Orient. Here we have this sword, and on the blade of that sword is written the word Kolbrin in ancient Negev, and is found in Pennsylvania. And we know what Philadelphia meant to the founding fathers of this country.
Right.
We know, we're just in the beginnings of this investigation. You know, when they found the Nakamadi text, Professor Robinson didn't publish his text until 1977. That was over 30 years after its discovery. The same thing with the Dead Sea Scrolls. We are in the very first year of publication of this text. There are so many avenues for investigation and research. Your audience gets a peek into history early, and that is wonderful. Anyway, this ancient Negev language...
Yeah, wait, stop for a second. So in the earliest version, I'm sorry to interrupt you, but I mean, was it in English? Or is it in Saxon, or what's the language that the earliest known version is in?
Negev.
Okay, that is a dialect of what?
Negev is a Middle Eastern language, like I said, was used by Eber, the patriarch of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. The ancient Negev is found in petroglyphs and on every single continent in the world. It's located in petroglyphs in Arizona. It's in California. Vindel Jones has found some in Texas. We find them, obviously, at our cave site in Illinois. This has been amazing to me. It's because when Wayne and I first went and gathered our first few hundred rune stones from the cave, they were in this weird language, and we couldn't read it. But we found James Harris, who could read ancient Negev, and suddenly he's reading to us the stories from the cave, and I'm going, oh, my gosh.
Well, you know, somebody asked me about that, too, the other day. They said, do you have an update on the Illinois cave excavations?
Well, we do. It's still in probate. And until that gets out of probate, no one can get into it. And it's been in probate and had some problems with ownership for the last 7 years. So, but that's hopefully going to resolve itself this spring. And, you know, we have never given up. We're like tenacious dogs. We don't give up on these things. We're going to bring it to coast to coast when we finally do it. But we've had runestones. We have hundreds of them that come out of the cave, and many of them are written in this ancient Negev language, which for the first time we can read and understand. And they have stories on it from this same Kolbrin manuscript, and the evidence is clear that these stories were once had in America.
All right, so the Negev language and these runestones of which you speak, they would have had to have come, though, into those Illinois caves up the Mississippi. Again, we're thinking from the Egyptians?
No, they would have come from the flight from the Roman armies in the first century, who went in and culminated in the destruction of Masada in 73 A.D. It would have been prior to that.
Okay, prior to that. Okay, thank you. So, now... back to Negev, and you were starting to say before I interrupted you. So this is what we have, and this is what we can read this, and it's just getting the kind of exposure that it deserves. But some of the stories, I think, are the most interesting parts of this. So I want you to address that Adam and Eve story after the next hour. But before we go any further, could you go back and talk about this idea of a space threat, of an ancient warning of a potential war of some sort?
Well, we know that the Mayans talked about a destruction of the Earth that would happen again in the year 2012. I know the heirs to the Inca throne, who, by the way, live in California now. I have spoken with them at length about their destruction sequences at the end of the Earth. For heaven's sake, Plato talked about the ultimate destructions of the Earth and ushering in 1,000 years of peace, which he called the return of Atlantis. The Christians call it the millennial era of time. The people of Mu talked about it, the return of Eden or Eden, or the Garden. In my opinion, it was that's where we get the terminology of the Garden of Eden. Every single culture talked about a destructive moment in time that is to come. Now, you've had brilliant guests. Marshall Masters, for example, has talked about this on your program, about the coming of this destroyer, the coming of Planet X. I'm not the one that probably should be the one being interviewed on that particular subject, because they have done such a brilliant job of doing that. But there, someday we're going to find out the reason why they put the most expensive observatory at the South Pole, because we cannot see what's coming to us from the Northern Hemisphere.
Well, then, but what is this space threat? I mean, if we could, if you could just address that, and this idea of the destroyer of this catastrophic, massive red comet that orbits our sun.
It's not a comet. It's a spherical, planetoid-like entity.
Okay, I was just reading off the back of your book. So they say massive red comet that orbits our sun, called the destroyer.
Yeah, but it doesn't orbit in the solar plane. In other words, all of the planets are in a kind of a plane like a disk. This particular orbiting body is in a juxtaposition with that orbit. It's coming. It only comes around every so many thousands of years. And it's predicted by the Mayans to return in 2012 again. And once again, the brilliant thing about the Colburn is that it gives a first-hand journalistic description of the last time it came around and what happened. What happened to the Earth? What happened to the people? How many people were destroyed? What were the events that occurred on the Earth?
And, because the Colburn goes into that the Earth was essentially created and then recreated. I read that earlier in the hour. Do you want to tell that story of how that supposedly came about?
Well, you know, once again, I think that you've already had other guests. I'm better at the history of the Exodus, etc. But yes, that what happens is this planetoid type body comes. It alters the magnetic poles. It causes the Earth to wobble, earthquakes and volcanoes. It causes some very specific changes in the Earth that mimic many things that look like the plagues of Egypt. If you read in the books of the Egyptians later on in the manuscript, which you probably haven't got to yet, it'll talk about the specific events that occur, which very much are like the plagues of Egypt, where they're the waters turn red, and that there are fish die, and that there are frogs and lice and things that feed on the bodies of those things.
Yep. I'll read from Manuscripts 3 here when it says, "When blood drops upon the earth, the destroyer will appear, and mountains will open up and belch forth fire and ashes. Trees will be destroyed, and all living things engulfed. Waters will be swallowed up by the land, and the seas will boil. The heavens will burn brightly and redly. There will be a copper hue over the face of the land, followed by a day of darkness. A new moon will appear and break up and fall. The people will scatter in madness. They will hear the trumpet and the battle cry of the destroyer, and will seek refuge within dens of the earth. Terror will eat away their hearts, and their courage will flow from them like water from a broken pitcher. They will be eaten up in the flames of wrath and consumed by the breath of the destroyer. In those days, men will have the great book before them. Wisdom will be revealed. The few will be gathered for the stand. It is the hour of trial. The dauntless ones will survive. The stout-hearted will not go down in destruction."
Remember in the book of Revelation, it said the moon would turn to blood?
Mm-hmm.
Well, this is describing the same event. This sphere comes with it with a cloud of iron ore, or many of the comets, many of the meteors that have an iron base, and apparently there is an iron debris field, which is much like a comet that surrounds us. But the difference between a comet is it's largely ice and stone. This one appears to be largely made of a heavy metal core with a debris field of iron ore, which will come out of the sky like drops of blood from the sky. It'll turn the moon to blood again. And, you know, the two stories are intertwined, like someone wrote the both texts, though they obviously were written very separately by different cultures at very different
right.
moments in time.
So then this book, it bounces around. We know that, you know, as you said, Edward I tries to find it, destroy it, look for help. Him use that to help get the Knights Templar. What happens to it after that? I mean, give us more of a timeline of what happens to the Colburn Bible.
Well, the Templars, remember, by the time of 1307, Philip the Fair and Clement V lived in France under the leadership, or under the monarchy of Philip the Fair. They go out to destroy these Templars, who, by the way, were all original members of the fraternal order of John the Baptist, okay?
Right.
Now, where did they go and exit? Where did they flee to? They fled to Scotland, which is very important, because what comes out of Scotland in our day? The Scottish rites of the Masonic Scottish rites. And many of the things that were taught in the ancient Colburn and in the amongst the Templars were inherited, brought over to the Americas with our founding fathers. So the Templars took this book to Scotland, and by the way, that's where it was preserved by a branch of the Templars until our day, until 1992, when there were copies disseminated around the world to various specific sources, before they took out a petition for dissolution in 1995. You notice that none of the copies of the Colburn are that old.
No, why would they not want this shared earlier? I mean, it doesn't seem like this gives the Knights Templar any particular power. They didn't have to worry anymore about religious persecution. I mean, after a certain point, you know, that even that doesn't happen in England or Scotland or anywhere else. So why not just put it out there?
Well, we're the first generation that would tolerate such a thing.
What do you mean by that? I mean, you had Nag Hammadi, you've got the Dead Sea Scrolls. That's a good time to throw
open. Well, that's our generation, too.
Yeah, but I mean, that's a good time to throw out the Colburn Bible.
Do you know how many movements are still in America who believe that Gnostics were evil, wicked men that were the dross of the earth, and the Gnostics being the authors of the Nag Hammadi Library itself? I mean, if the Nag Hammadi Library would have been founded at the time of the founding fathers, they would have killed them. They would. It just after the time of the Templars. Now remember that this ushered in the Spanish Inquisition.
Well, I get why they wouldn't mention it at the times of the Spanish Inquisition. That's totally fair. But you would think, really, from I don't know 1850 forward or something like that, you could have released something like this, and nothing bad would have happened to you.
Well, you get 800 years of hiding a document under
okay.
your belt.
Yeah.
You get used to hiding it. And you
force
look
of habit.
To bring it about.
Right, okay. All right, so out of force of habit, it only comes out until recently. The Colburn Bible. We'll continue this conversation coming up next hour. We won't get to your calls yet because we're just really getting down to a couple of the stories Glenn wanted to mention. Are you prepared to go to the Colburn Bible's version of Adam and Eve? Will you give us a reading on that, Glenn, coming up, and talk about the significance of
we'll
that?
We'll talk about the significance.
Okay, coming up then on Coast to Coast AM.